Welcome to the Global Marketing Show, the podcast for all things international business. I'm your host, Wendy Pease, president of Rapport International and a translation expert. Come along with me today as we talk to an expert in the global marketing world about facing their biggest fears, hearing about mistakes they made or saw, discussing best practices, and sharing fun travel language and culture stories. Hi, thanks for joining the Global Marketing Podcast. Today we welcome Tim Resendez of Osborne Clark. He is a brand new father and he's also an expert on helping companies expand international. So welcome, Tim.
Thanks, Wendy. It's great to be here today.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Me too.
So you are a lawyer and a business development professional. And you're the only American attorney that works at Osborne Clark, right?
That's right. Yeah, I have a very unique role. In fact, across the entire legal industry, where I'm a U.S. lawyer licensed in New York. I advise companies, but have entered a very unique space where I'm the only American lawyer at a firm that doesn't practice U.S. law at all. So everything we do is cross-border. And as the sole American, I understand the U.S. market and work with many of our U.S. clients, but we're advising them purely on their international legal needs. So I work with U.S. clients here in the States and then work with lawyers from around the world that help to deliver the legal advice. And I spend a lot of my time working with our clients here directly and then managing their projects, working with Global Legal Counsel. So very much a niche I've been involved in and have done it for about 12 years now. I got started working with one of the foreign government economic development agencies after law school, working with fast-growing tech companies from Silicon Valley going into the UK market. So I've been working with advising companies going international from the US for a long time now.
All right, so you live in New York and you got your BA in global business from USC, California, and you got your JD in international corporate law from Santa Clara University. So you've lived on either coast. Have you ever lived internationally?
Yeah, two times. So I'd been a year at university at USC. I went and studied in Amsterdam for a year. So I spent an entire year, first time in Europe, showed up with a suitcase and spent the next year there. Work both with, I lived with American students and foreign students, and then attended university with Dutch and international students. So it was a really interesting year. I didn't learn as much Dutch as I would have liked because everybody spoke English there.
Right, yeah.
But great experience, learned a lot, traveled a lot, met some great people. So that was kind of my first foray into doing anything internationally. And then about 5 years ago, I worked out of our London office. So I did a secondment. I'm working on some special projects across our technology industry groups based out of the London office, which was another great experience.
Okay, so the first time you really had global living experience was when you went to Amsterdam in college, but you majored in global business. So what got you interested in the global arena?
I don't know. I've always gravitated to it in some way. I grew up in Seattle, Washington, and is very much kind of up in the corner of the world, you know, similar to Boston over on this coast. Mm-hmm. And really wanted to kind of get out there and see the world more. And, you know, I was always interested in that, even though I hadn't experienced a ton growing up. But, you know, I'd gone to Mexico or gone to different countries a bit here and there and was interested in it. And then, of course, I've always been a history and international affairs junkie. So that got me into kind of the international side to things. And then I've always gravitated towards the business world from early days. So in university, it was kind of a mix of both a business degree and international relations.
Yeah. All right. So I love to ask this question with all the guests that we have on. What's your favorite foreign word?
Sure. I actually have a pretty new one. I'd heard it before, but since we've been in a coronavirus environment, I had a little extra free time and started to pick up some Italian. And in studying that, every single resource I've looked at, within the first few lessons, they all talk about this one phrase, which apparently is highly used all the time. It's called in bocca al lupo, which means into the wolf's mouth, which is similar to break a leg in English. So you know, before a big performance or recording a podcast, for instance, you might tell somebody into the wolf's mouth. And then you're apparently not allowed to say grazie or, you know, thank you of some sort. You have to say crepi a lupo, which means may the wolf die. So it's a very funny, like, idiomatic phrase. I don't quite understand the whole genesis of it, but it's apparently used pretty frequently just because every resource I've looked at is one of the first things they teach you, you know, how to say what your name is, nice to meet you, what's your name, how are you? And then it's this invoca al lupo phrase.
That is hysterical. I have, I took some Italian lessons and I went over to Italy for an extended time there and I never even heard that. So I love it. And bocca al lupo, huh?
Apparently. I'll have to look out for it next time I'm there and see if I can use it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we'll have to do a little Friday fun fact about bocca al lupo. All right. So you work with a ton of clients that are going international because that's what you specialize in. What would you say their biggest fear is about doing business internationally?
Yeah, and I've seen it time and time again, but I think the overreaching thing is the U.S. is a known market, or your home market, for instance, is the place you know what works, you know how what your product is, how it fits, how you need to do conduct business, what you need to do from a legal logistics process perspective. Anything outside the US is almost like starting over. And the perception is that the risks are higher, that getting it wrong will be costly, that's a waste of time, resource, and focus, which if not done right, it can be. And there are some additional challenges. So different languages, different ways of doing business, different currency, product market fit might not be the best. You know, you're not a well-known brand or don't have the same network in a foreign country. So it's a well-founded fear. But for me, especially as a lawyer, helping the clients get comfortable, understand what the risks are to their business, both legally and from a wider business perspective, is a key part of the early stage conversations I have with clients, just to get them comfortable to understand and quantify what those risks are to them. There's obviously opportunity costs if they're going after international opportunities versus something domestically, but it's such a big world and there are so many great markets around the world that could be potentially great growth opportunities for clients that I work with, that typically if they're comfortable with that, and we'll get into what it takes to be successful, but a lot of that comes down to having that plan and getting comfortable with what the risks are. And then having strategies in place to mitigate that or pivot or pull back or test the market. Some of those types of approaches work really well, where understanding what the risks are, how to mitigate it initially, how to go after more opportunity if things go well, but also how you can retrench a bit or pivot the approach if things don't go according to plan.
So you mentioned that there are many great markets around the world. What markets, can you give us some stories about clients that have had success, or which markets are the hot ones or the good ones to go into?
Yeah, I mean, it depends. As a lawyer, I must say it depends. Very unsatisfying answer, but it really does. I mean, most of the clients I've worked with have been fast-growing companies or venture-backed companies that are going after new revenue opportunities. Most of the time, that's driven by having a good market hold in the US where they understand the market, they have a product out and have been reasonably successful here, and then either have the financial means or have raised a funding round to then go after international opportunities. So a few approaches to that. If let's say a tech company I work with, let's say a SaaS company, that its product could have international reach from the moment it's available, then it's really a matter of going after foreign markets with the right sales and marketing approach to reach that. Companies in that space typically will put kind of a foreign beachhead in place. Let's say they're going after the EMEA region, will put in place a sales leader or a country leader, whether that's somebody hired in country or sent over from the US in the days when people can travel and get visas for people to go over. And then maybe set up in a place where it's just easy to do business, like the UK, but then go after the market opportunity across Europe. There's also things like Brexit that are changing that approach, and there are a number of factors. So if a company does need to be within the European Union, then the UK might not be a good fit. But a lot of those fast-growing tech companies, especially in SaaS, go to places like Ireland as a bit of a beachhead. The Netherlands is pretty popular these days. European market opportunities, your biggest one's going to be Germany if you can penetrate that market. So it's really understanding where your product market fit can be, where is a good business environment from which to start trading and go after wider opportunities. I also work with companies that start in, let's say, LATAM regions because that's where their network is or their product fits better. And so they look at it that more on a regional basis. And same with the APAC region. So for whatever reason, most of my clients go into Singapore as kind of the regional hub, less so Hong Kong, especially these days. And so, and especially within the tech space, Singapore is perceived to be the hub through which to trade across APAC, especially Southeast Asia, while still getting you close to continental Asia markets and China potentially, if that's key. So, and even a beachhead into India, for instance. So my clients typically start off going into the hubs in which to hit the wider region. And then from there, let's say a company sets up, puts that first team on the ground in the UK, but they've seen the German market is doing really well and they want to double down on that effort and put a small team on the ground to start going after the German market specifically or to get better reach into continental Europe. And same for a company that might start in Singapore, but then start to put regional pieces in place. A market like Japan, where you kind of need to be there in the market and be very localized in your approach, is one where I see companies that might start in Singapore, but then put a team in Japan shortly thereafter, or South Korea, places like that.
Okay, interesting. So you kind of look at EMEA or LATAM or APAC. And just, to define the terms, EMEA would be the Europe, Middle East, LATAM would be Latin America, and APAC would be the Asian Pacific countries, just so we make sure we're all talking. Yeah. So it sounds like a client will pick one of those areas, and then within that area, they pick a beachhead. And then expand from there, rather than saying, I'm going to do these three markets and pick three different
beachheads. Yeah. Yeah, I've seen different approaches, and like I said, it depends really on the industry and what the product is and what makes sense for that company. I do find, let's say, in that software as a service company example, where it really is a boots on the ground sales presence, where they can have a team sitting in a beachhead that can target and go after market opportunities in different countries across the region. Or in many cases, I've seen a beachhead, but you might, let's say, and this is pre-Brexit, but we had many clients that would put a London office in place, but then hire someone to sell into the German market, someone to sell into the French market, somebody to sell into the Spanish market, but all based in London. So they could go be in country as needed. They were both a Spanish national, for instance, but living in London. So you could kind of tap into a full regional capability, but everybody being based in the same place. But then being localized for the specific markets within the region. I've seen that work really well, especially where it's more of a digital product or you don't need to be distributing physical products across a market like that.
Oh, that's great insight to look at that. Okay, so you said somebody might go into LATAM if most of their connections are down there. I've heard so many different stories about how companies pick where they're going into. Number one is it's a lot of English. Number two, it might be where the business owner is from, might be where the business owner likes to travel. And then I hear that their strategy. What's the flow there? What are you seeing come up when people are picking an area to go into?
Sure. So, well, that answer really depends. For my more corporate clients that, let's say, have institutional venture capital investors with an outside board and really trying to do things in a way that makes sense across all those stakeholders, most of the time, the best approach there will be purely strategy driven. It might be based on where there is perhaps a key hire in a foreign jurisdiction, or where, let's say, one of the co-founders is from another country and so has that network, or even they're doing software development there because they have that network and costs are lower, let's say. So that is the approach. And most of the time I would counsel a company to, if they can do market testing beforehand to kind of A/B test or see where customer demand is. Many of my clients are digital, so they might see, wow, we have 30% of our customers are across the European region or 40% are across LATAM. Okay, there's a real opportunity there. We should go, one, to be in market to service our existing customers, if that's important, or two, to double down and go take advantage of that opportunity and perhaps continue to scale within that region. I would say that very strategic research and market-driven approach within a strategy for both market entry, how to pivot, and how to scale would be the ideal. I've seen many times when it might be more driven by where the founder likes to the vacation or particularly keen on a particular city they like to travel to or do business, or even where that key hire is really the driver. But it might be somebody they met on the plane, you know, a transatlantic flight, they met that person, they happen to be based somewhere, and you know, they don't do the same due diligence they might on a domestic hire and going into a new market in the States, but might then bring this person on board who I'm sure can sell them on all the revenue opportunities they're going to go chase down in that foreign country. But many times those, of course, don't work out. I find that the more research objective driven approaches make the most sense. But I don't want to discount the fact that having a network outside the US that you can leverage in a way that really fits into the wider business strategy, whether that's for developing your product or for actually going after that region as a potential market, is definitely worth leveraging if you have that capability.
Okay. All right. So you've been talking about some industries, about the SaaS and the technology. What industries are you seeing have great success, or who would you recommend to go international?
Yeah, like I said, most of my client base, being based in Silicon Valley previously and now spending most of my time in New York or Boston or kind of tech hotbeds, have been in the wider digital technology, media, comms, and maybe life science space, most of which are venture capital backed and are on a pretty strong growth trajectory. So I'm talking to them as they're looking to go into their first jurisdiction overseas, or they're looking to continue to scale. And we're kind of rest of world providers to our clients here. So we're able to help them no matter where they're going in the world. So because of that, in some cases, we're very early in that process. And other times we come in later. That being said, you know, the coronavirus has kind of changed the calculation in some ways as to where people are going around the world or what types of industries. Anything in tech is doing pretty well, so long as it's not, let's say, travel industry, hospitality, leisure, things like that have been significantly impacted. That's been one of the challenging areas within tech. But I have a ton of clients that are in the wider technology space, communication, SaaS. You know, we're doing this on a Zoom call. Well, you know, those are the types of companies that are doing great in this environment and are seeing great growth overseas. I've also seen that as in the US, we're still somewhat locked down and we're still coming out of this environment. Well, many places around the world have opened back up or did and are in some stages. So for my clients, they've actually kind of doubled down overseas because they've seen markets opening up there ahead of the US. But we'll see how that develops. Largely, it's these tech players that have done really well. I've worked with a lot of consumer product companies, some that have worked either through, you know, distribution channels, others that have built their own brand that do a direct-to-consumer play. So they might be purely e-commerce and then start to dabble into a brick-and-mortar presence. Some companies I've worked with have done that in a measured way where they would start to market to some key regions. So I'll use an apparel company as a for instance. They kind of did the research. They saw where the demand is. They tested some marketing to see where they could build some of that pipeline outside the US. And then from that, they kind of developed their top five market list. And then from there, started putting in place the channels to then do the e-commerce distribution model into those. And then once they had that lever turned up, they started putting in pop-up stores or ways to build both a distribution channel, but really a brand building exercise. So they really drove it from an online model to then more brick and mortar, both to build the initial pipeline, then to do the brand building exercise and have distribution channels across the region. And that client, for instance, did it in both Europe and Asia simultaneously, because some of their top five regions were within there. And so that was really interesting. Another area to mention, being based in New York and being a London headquartered firm, we do a lot in fintech. So kind of the coming together of both the financial services industries that are huge in these two cities, combined with the tech layer, which is where I've had most of my experience through my career. And there's a lot of back and forth. We're obviously working with companies that are going from the US to, let's say, London and through to European or Asian markets. But then I've seen quite a few of our overseas clients that are in fintech, payments, software within the financial service vertical. Many of them have come into the US market. And New York is a great place to come into. Obviously, all the vertical markets are here, especially if you're selling into financial services. So fintech definitely makes the international leap quite a bit. And then the only other thing to mention there is, I think we're seeing the supply chains change a bit in the current environment. So I've been working with companies that are looking at and evaluating where they're sourcing product, where their key markets are, how to build resiliency within that, rethinking where their production will be and how they'll get supplied to the market, and really building greater strength within that. And this is a time I think everybody's reevaluating their business, both domestically and abroad. So and that applies across companies in all industries. And I do a lot in life sciences. So medical device would be one, for instance, where the European market is really interesting. Regulatory approvals are typically much quicker in Europe versus the US. And so I work with quite a few medical device companies that go into the European market, but then they're also considering where their production is of their products, and maybe not even selling in the US yet, but they're selling into Europe, producing in Asia, and then have the supply lines through there. So it really depends on the company, and we're also seeing the impact the past 6 months of how coronavirus has reshaped how we're building international businesses right now.
Right, right. What are some of the biggest mistakes you've seen happen with clients or companies?
Sure. So I've seen quite a few over the years, but I've seen quite a few successes too. I mean, it goes across the board.
Next, but I want to dig into mistakes now.
Yeah.
Forewarned is forearmed, right?
Absolutely. I think the one thing to say there is planning and have a strategy, have timelines, have metrics for success. It's the situations where it is that kind of spur of the moment. There's a strategic hire. We need to go do it. We need to be in this market. Or somebody sitting in the board says, you need to be international tomorrow. Just go make it happen. And then, you know, the controller at the company is not used to dealing with those types of projects, because there's so many stakeholders involved in these type of projects. So it really involves a planning process that looks at where are your key markets potentially, where's their product market fit, where are your customers going to be, where are the places that it's best to structure or conduct your business from on that regional basis, like we talked about, and then have a timeline. And if that timeline, test it to ensure that it's achievable, because the worst thing you can do is hope to be somewhere tomorrow, but it takes you 6 months. And then by the time that's passed, the opportunity is gone. Or in fact, to have timelines that you expect a huge spike in revenue in a very short timeline, when in fact it might take a year or two or three to actually be established in a market to build that up. But in fact, once you've built that, you have a more sustainable and loyal customer base. And so it's worth investing that time. But all that should be built into that strategy. And then the only other thing I'd mention within it is have a plan B if things don't go according to plan. So ability to pivot, to retrench, to stay flexible and nimble within it. And especially in this environment. I mean, we've seen a lot of companies that have taken a new approach to what they've done overseas to date and are adjusting to that. Not necessarily retrenching, but just taking a more holistic view of where's their revenue coming from, where are their customers, how are they servicing them, and where are they going to build future revenue. Companies where I've seen it doesn't go well, I would say examples of getting the hiring wrong. People are so important to this. And in fact, it's even more important outside the US. One, because you don't know the market, have the network most likely. And also, you're bringing somebody in to take this on that you haven't really worked with in the past. So that can be a big challenge, and there's no easy way to do that. But finding the right person or team to lead the overseas market entry is really key. Getting it wrong can really hurt you both in terms of starting over and having to bring somebody new in to start leading the charge. But also, as a lawyer looking at it, employment regulations are much stricter outside the US and they're much more employer friendly. So getting it wrong will be more costly. It will take more time. And the employment markets outside the US aren't as dynamic. So it's almost impossible to hire somebody tomorrow. There might be a notice period or things that prevent you from just onboarding somebody right away. And then, of course, like I mentioned, getting it wrong, moving on from that person, let's say, can be more of a challenge and more costly. So getting the people right is very important. And then just to mention one other thing that I've seen go wrong quite a bit is understanding what the sales cycle is like in that market. And most of the time, it will be longer than what you're used to in the US, especially in places like continental Europe. I use Germany as an example where I've seen a couple software companies I've worked with that hired what looks like the right team on the ground. They might be doing all the right things, but they're not showing results right away. But that's because they need 6 meetings with that prospect in order to even start talking about, concluding a sale. And so it might take them 12 months to do that, to start showing results. But at that point, they've built a much more loyal customer. And they've really invested that time. Whereas if you pulled the plug on that person 11 months in, you've had nothing to show for it. And they were just at the precipice of making that initial big sale that then is their case study that they can use across the market and really leverage that to both understanding the market and knowing your people and knowing what works and what the expectation should be and having the right expectations going in to the extent you can.
Right. Yeah. Because that's so different from the United States. If you've got somebody, a new salesperson that's not showing anything in 6 months, it wouldn't stand for that in the U.S.
Right. One quarter is enough here.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. How about language issues? I mean, you've talked about all over the world. You're seeing English, you're seeing problems with that. How are your clients typically handling that?
I mean, as you've probably seen, I think at least for conducting business, English, generally speaking at a high level and as a lawyer involved, I mean, we conduct most of our work with our U.S. client in English. So all of my colleagues from around the world, we have offices, 26 offices across Europe and Asia. We conduct all of our business, at least cross-border with the U.S., in English. But in most jurisdictions we work in, there will be translation needs. Whether it is things like their marketing materials and getting localized, both in messaging and in terms of the copy and how they're approaching it that way. It might be things like the sales contract then that the team's using there. And then for us, we do a lot across, like I mentioned, employment or all those documents typically need to be translated. So and that's because there are those regulations as to what employers need to do. So we do work a lot across the translation space. I'd say most of our companies, the clients I've worked with, I feel like the market has become more sophisticated, that they typically have a better view. There are more advisors like myself or others out there, and a lot of in-house professionals that have done this in the past and have that playbook for what it takes to succeed outside the US. And they have an understanding of, okay, here's what we need in terms of our personnel. Here's what we need in terms of advisors. Here's what we need to have for a marketing playbook. And here's what our sales process needs to look like. And whether that's that localization from a language perspective, whether that's having the sales team that is, a German national selling in the German market, because that matters both from a language standpoint, but culturally as well, and understanding what it takes to be successful in order to communicate whether it's negotiate, communicate, build relationships, or really deliver that message in the market. It is really key. It's kind of that be global, but act local to the extent that's possible. We see that, you know, it's kind of something people have said for a long time, but I have seen it be really a key to success, especially in markets where I say from a US perspective, Canada, UK, Australia, places like that are easy. It's English, it's more familiar. Once you get into other markets where the culture might be very different, or of course, language, you know, English might not be the business language there. And so of course that becomes crucial to actually even be able to do business there.
And so how are your clients going about finding a translator firm that they could trust?
I think it's still down to referrals. I mean, that as a from a legal perspective, almost all of our work comes from referrals. I'm sure for you that's the case. And so it's referrals are interesting because they reflect both on you making the referral as they do on the person providing the service. So what we found is people that we've worked with in the past that our clients have fed back and had a good experience with, and we feel comfortable recommending to our clients. I've seen it go very well in many cases. I've seen some challenges along the way. I know there are kind of different players, whether it's the kind of tech solutions within this, but most of the times I've worked with traditional translation services that have the language expertise and are true experts in this. And then I think I like to work with people that work in the same way we do, where we're hyper responsive. That's why I'm in the time zone of my clients sitting here, but advising them globally. You know, you do the same thing, right? Working with clients to help them with translations globally, but being in market. So having that very strong service standpoint with the skill sets has always been the key to making it work from what I've seen.
Right. And so you started talking a little bit about the technology versus the traditional, which I'll call human translation. What are you seeing in that area?
Sure. It's not my direct area of expertise, but I have seen some companies looking to just take a light touch approach, and maybe they're not going where I've seen it work is if the human-centric language approach to key markets of where if it's legal docs, absolutely. If it's marketing messaging that is a key market, as they determine through that planning and research and that strategy, getting it right is really important. So I would say don't take the chances there. I would be more risk adverse. If it is we want to be in 180 countries, so we need some localized language on, you know, a website or some marketing materials, I'd say there you could go with a lighter touch, lower cost, something that's not perfect, but at least gets you closer and might, for little investment, might turn on new opportunities for revenue or growth. So I think it's about prioritizing both whatever the translation need is or the market. So high risk is legal. High risk are your key markets where you know you need to be successful or where there's a real opportunity. Lower risk are kind of everything else where it's not mission critical, it's not high risk, and it's kind of a nice to have. I'd say there I'd be comfortable. Well, I guess we'll see over time, you know, how those services develop. And with machine learning, these things move pretty quickly. So we'll see. That calculation might change. What do you see? How do you see the space right now?
Well, I just did a recording. It's about a 15-minute one on the problems with Google Translate, which I'm using as a general term for machine translation, about why it's never going to be able to catch up with language, and also the legal liability. I think it's only a matter of time where somebody's going to be sued for using machine translation on something important because it's not accurate. And somebody's going to lean on it. So I think it's only a matter of time. So I'll be really interested to watch and see what kind of case it is. I mean, already there was a case down in Universal Studios because there's, you know, the warnings they have outside of the big scary rides that say if you have a heart condition or you're pregnant, don't ride.
Right.
There was a gentleman who spoke Spanish who had a heart attack, didn't understand the sign, and there ended up being a case on it. So I hope they're Spanish labeling down there now. I haven't followed up on it, but I know that case was brought, and you know, anytime there's a case, it's a lot of aggravation and money for those of us involved who aren't the attorneys.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's
without an attorney. I mean,
that's a good use case. I didn't mention it before, but product labeling is something we come across all the time. And if you're dealing across the European Union, you need to translate. There are specific languages that are required on each package or within the insert. And getting that type of thing right, because it is a regulatory requirement, and if it's not done properly, you could be in hot water depending on what the issue is. Those are the types of things that you probably don't want to use an electronic translator, especially where there is legal liability potentially for it.
Right. Yeah. So what about things that have gone right? What can you give us examples of companies that decided to go international and how they took it through the process and why they were successful?
Yeah. So like I said, there's been quite a few that have been successful. I'd say one interesting example I can point to is it's a marketplace for, let's say, high level, it's a real estate marketplace, connecting people with space and people that are looking for space on a short-term basis. They took an interesting approach by looking at each market individually, because for what they do, it in some cases fell into being a regulated industry. So each country, let's say, needed a different approach, both from a regulatory perspective, from a structural perspective, and as they looked at it from a market entry approach. So this one started off in the UK, building an organic business, sending somebody over to help build the team, get the culture right across the organization, and then hiring locally to build that team and train up kind of the next leader who would look after that market for them. And that made sense for them in the UK, but for what they did, they really needed to be in country and in fact in market to kind of key holiday destinations, let's say. And for them, that meant that they did need more boots on the ground on a much wider footprint. And so getting that balance right of having the right people in the right places, ensuring kind of regulatory compliance along the way and looking at each market individually made a lot of sense for their business. And for them, they set up that organic presence in the UK. But for Germany, there was an existing startup that was doing pretty well there and kind of had the right team in place and people in the right places. And so they actually acquired them, which is also another market entry approach to consider. So where there is a prime target that really speeds up the ability to be able to be growing and successful in a new market, the acquisition route is something we work on quite a bit, whether it's kind of bolting on to existing overseas operations or as a first step overseas. Most of the time it's bolting on to, hey, we have a small team in one country, there's an adjacent opportunity that kind of gets us into a new market and take advantage of that. And then from there, they did more of an organic approach. And that was initially into Europe and European markets, but then from there went into Asian markets and then eventually LATAM after that. So they became a big global player. And from that, we helped them set up that first company in the UK and hired the first person and did some very basic stuff. And their approach was interesting because they would do so much of that work ahead of time. And they approached each market differently. So even though their marketing team was sitting back in San Francisco, they were looking at each jurisdiction they were going to as a completely new business that they were building. So they needed to understand what the market opportunity was, whether that product really fit, how they could go after it. And then they really tested their messaging around it. So what worked, and doing it digitally made sense for a market platform like that, which is something you can really do for a business and know that you have the marketing right, you have a pipeline of demand, and you're effectively creating a marketplace between that demand, and then you need to build supply of spaces for people to stay in that use case. And so from that, they were able to really understand all of this ahead of time going in, and then can modify the approach depending on the market. That worked really well, but as you can tell, that's a pretty intensive approach. Most of my clients don't do it that way, and even them, they had some challenges in different countries, whether it was the product didn't fit or they had some regulatory issues here and there. So it's always fraught with ups and downs. It's like we talked about at the beginning. It can be risky. It is challenging and it's hard to get it right. But I think taking that really measured approach that they did worked really well. Just to throw another example out there.
Wait, back on that one, how long did that take them to really feel like they had a presence in each market from when they picked the strategy?
Oh, I'd say it took years, really. But once they were able to know what they were getting into, understand what the strategy was, and then start to execute on it, they were very successful very quickly, with some of the ups and downs, of course, but something like 6 months to then have a business in place, a team to manage that, and then have the right people that could really scale it. And then once they could do that, then they could invest into more marketing for that specific market. So have a regional marketing manager and really build a team then to build off of what they were able to create. So I wouldn't say it was the lightest touch approach, but I would say that type of approach was the most market research driven and A/B tested and had the knowledge. And then as they did that in one country, they built off that and knew what some of the pitfalls might be going into the next country. So I found that to be working with them through the years was really interesting to see how they approach each market, how they leverage the experience they already have, probably encounter new issues in each new place they went, but then could instill that into what their playbook was for each new market entry. And then, of course, looking at each market differently and shifting the approach as needed.
Okay, so I've heard that before too, is pick a market, go through it, develop a playbook or an implementation plan, and then take that and drop it into other markets as you go on. Yeah.
In different industries, I mean, in some cases, if you're selling software, it's different versus that, which is a marketplace. I worked with some that are more of a real estate technology play where it involves a big investment in building the real estate themselves. And in those, I think it's worth doing more upfront investment and research and finding the right locations and doing all that due diligence for that market entry, because it is a riskier proposition. It's not just, you can't just dip your toe in the water, you know, sell online or hire one person and see if they can be successful. You are, you know, investing in assets, you're building a team, you're trying to build a new business. And those are the ones where you do need to be more risk adverse and plan versus others where you can distance sell and kind of see what works. And then if things seem to work well, go and double down on that opportunity.
So you've talked a lot about hiring. What about hiring employees versus distributors versus agents? Like, how does a company make a decision of how deep to get in or how to put boots on the ground?
Yeah, good question. And I think it goes back to, again, what the product is and what the market is. So having that product market fit, knowing you might have, for that last example, it might be one approach in one market, but a different approach in others. So I've seen quite a few where they're doing direct sales with a team in country, but then might have distributors for other markets. I do find distribution and sales agents in Europe, for instance, there are more regulations around it. So if it doesn't go right, or you're looking to move away from that model and go to more of a direct selling model, it is more challenging to wind that down just because there are many protections in place. So definitely worth flagging that from a legal perspective, that if you start with distribution, sales agents, it's highly regulated. And if you're moving from that approach or that approach doesn't work, winding that down or moving to a direct selling model does take time and takes more effort or monetary investment to make sure you do it right. So I think worth knowing that ahead of time. But I've seen both be successful. Obviously, one is lighter touch, less risk, but also less upside, even if it is successful. But it is an easy way to scale the business globally, to find the right partners and distributors. So where I've seen it work well is if you have some of those key markets where you think you can be successful and have the right team and go after it and do it directly, that's really ideal. But then you might have, let's say, secondary markets or regions where there might be good partners or distributors you could be working with, that from a light touch, low investment standpoint, you're able to start to get your products into those markets. And if you are hyper successful, that's a great problem to have. So how do you go and, you know, find a solution that works better in terms of that initial deal you worked out, or start to do things directly or change the approach? So that does help you maintain flexibility. The thing is, if you do go direct and you're hiring, let's say, full time, and it doesn't go well, then, you know, that's when you run into some of those challenges of maybe moving on from that existing team or winding down in one country. But I think as we're seeing in coronavirus landscape, people are taking more flexible approaches, and different different ways of approaching new markets, different ways of structuring their teams, finding ways to try to hire people kind of short term or more on like a contract basis, which can, there are some legal issues to look out for there, the whether somebody's a contractor or an employee and how they're structured and whether they create a taxable presence. So definitely worth checking with a lawyer, having a chat with your accountants, knowing a bit of this beforehand and how you look to structure it. But both approaches can definitely work. It really just depends what the market is and what your industry is and what makes the most sense there. And my only advice there is, you know, do research, but also ask your peer companies, ask your, you know, other stakeholders across the business, ask and start to network within that region to the extent you're able to really build that network. Because that's the challenge, especially if you're not already in a particular region. If you don't have a network, you don't quite know the market, it's really worth finding people you can trust that can, you can build that network and have people you can rely on to make referrals or get connected to, you know, that right partner that might be a good fit for that region. So those are some of the things you can do beforehand as you're looking to scale somewhere else around the world or for the first time.
So here I am sitting in Boston, and let's pretend I'm a manufacturer and I decide, yeah, I do want to go international and I want to build a network out, and I pick Spain. How would I start building a network?
Good question. Well, you know, that's, I guess I used to work for a government economic development agency, so I might as well give them a little pitch, because they, every country, and I know Spain specifically has a good program that offer free services and connections for any company that's looking to go into that market. So if you want some free advice, some network that's ready made, some of them actually do a service to connect you with potential partners or help you network. Most of them are looking for foreign direct investment in their market. So if you're looking to sell or create jobs or set up a manufacturing facility in that case, potentially, you know, they're ready and willing and able to help, and it won't cost you very much. And the US government also has services for that too. Especially in that use case, a lot of what they do is around building partnerships or looking for distributors in different regions. So that's US commercial service. For that type of example, that's probably where I would start. The other thing is talking
to US commercial service. So if one of our listeners wants to find it, they could go to US commercial service and find them.
Yeah. So US commercial services, I believe it's part of the Department of Commerce, and they have, I think it's called Export USA, or at least it used to be. And that service was largely around finding distributors, and they have a lot of information about each market, in addition to specific services they can do. And I think the way they structured was really actually for that use case where somebody's looking for distributors in a particular region, and then they kind of have a list or recommendations that they make off the back of that. And then you have the in-country teams, like I'm sure it's called Invest Spain or something like that. It's the Spanish government FDI organization that can give you more of a local viewpoint of that. And most of them have done this for a long time. They have offices. Almost every country has an office in New York that's looking for American companies that want to go and do business there. So I'd say that's an easy starting point and definitely a light touch, low cost. Right. And then I think it's digging into your existing network. Who do you know on LinkedIn that's done business somewhere? Who do you know that's adept at doing business cross-border or might have a network in that region, or your peers in that space that have done, you know, distributed into different countries around the world or may have done some business in Spain? Obviously, that's a good starting point, and then you can hopefully leverage that into building your own ready-made network for a region like that.
Right, right. So early you mentioned a lot of the companies that you're working with are VC funded, or they've gotten investment from somewhere. What percent of your clients do you think are VC funded versus self-funded, independent?
Yeah, I'd say maybe a quarter aren't venture backed or publicly traded at this point. Where we come into the market, it's usually at that precipice of a company that has been successful in the U.S. at least initially, and they're ready to go and build additional revenue outside the U.S. And so, mm-hmm. to some degree, they may know where they're looking to go, or they might come to us, and we'll have those conversations about how they should structure that, what might be a good fit for their company, and then we help them implement that, and then we bring in a team of other advisors that can help for anything non-legal. So we're pretty astute at working across the board with other advisors that are adept at running these projects.
And is there a difference between how the VC funded versus the, you know, non-funded companies would approach going to market or international?
Yeah, I mean, so the VC funded company will have investors behind them and have a timeline and a growth trajectory that they're trying to achieve with those metrics. So it really is chasing down revenue growth and scale or user growth. I think now it's much more driven by revenue and customers and how they can scale in that way. So that's why we've worked with so many that have that funding, because they have a timeline for growth that they need to go and achieve. And in many cases, international markets provide the fastest growth trajectory that they can go and scale quickly, that starts to hit those metrics for their investors. And they have the financing to go and do that too. So if they raise a nice B round of a couple tens of millions and then can go after a new market overseas, you know, that can be a nice new revenue stream that they can, you know, start to have, let's say 20% of their total revenue out of the European market by putting in place a small team and going to market without having to invest too much. So that's why we've worked with a lot of those companies. And then of course we have some pretty basic services that help them get up and running quickly in those markets. And then we scale with them. So we have kind of light touch approaches to help them just with the initial market entry. And then of course we advise them and can advise across the entire legal needs that they might have as they scale or go into new countries. Mm-hmm. They're after scale at all costs. I would say non-institutional owned or invested obviously are at a different timeline, and they can be a bit more wait and see and take a more cautious approach because they don't have outside pressure that really is pushing them down that revenue growth stream. And then our other clients, many of which are publicly traded as well. So a lot of them have different metrics and growth timelines. But by that point, most of our clients, by the time they do reach IPO, have at least a few international offices. They have a decent international customer base. And so many of them were fast-growing venture-backed companies that reached scale, that had international as a big part of their growth trajectory, and then were able to have a successful IPO and be a growing publicly traded company off the back of that, which then, of course, changes the whole structure of how they look to grow. And then we have quite a few that are institutionally owned that might exit through a PE investor or, in some cases, get acquired. So in many cases, they kind of get subsumed or wrapped up into the acquiring company, whereas others are still operate largely individually. So we've seen many, many approaches, but that kind of growth trajectory of the VC-funded companies is really where we've come in, because we understand what their risk profile is. We know they need to grow quickly. We know legal is perceived as, let's say, a barrier, something that isn't the thing they'd want to focus on. You know, they want to go get revenue and, you know, drive sales and open up new channels overseas. So we can help facilitate that. That's what we try to do.
Oh, okay. Okay. So that really seems like it's a sweet spot you've targeted. You can help everyone. But there's no benefit to being VC funded for somebody who wants to go international.
Right. Other than having the funds to do it, but the challenge there is you might have timelines that are challenging to achieve though. You know, right. You have metrics that you need to hit, and like we said, sales cycles might be longer overseas and it might take time to achieve that. So having that pressure might make it more of a challenge to be successful outside the US in some cases.
And what are the benefits that you see for selling international? Like, why should a company do it if you've got the whole US to sell in?
Yeah, and I have that conversation a lot. It's interesting because we have, as a firm, most of our lawyers and consequently most of our clients are based outside the US. So they look at the US as this big, amazing market that they need to come into. But it's coming into the US market is fraught with its own challenges. It's a big market, and if you just get a small percentage of it, you know, you'd be amazingly successful. But achieving that kind of success coming in this direction could definitely be a challenge. For US company, I mean, what I find is that, especially for the type of fast growth companies we're working with, there are so many untapped market opportunities here, especially if I'm working with my tech clients that are really innovative, cutting edge, are kind of creating a new business model or new technology that doesn't exist outside the US. So you almost have greenfield opportunities with no competitors in some cases, or you might have adjacent players or a small competitor that you could acquire and quickly scale and bring in your technology and leverage that. I'd also say what I'm seeing now that we've moved to a largely remote work environment for a lot of us is people are rethinking where their headcount sits. I mean, we're sitting in Boston and New York respectively. The cost of talent in our markets is very high and the competition for talent is very high. Whereas if you can hire similar skill sets that could work remotely, be based outside the US, but at a much lower cost and still able to deliver that similar type of value, that approach can work. Traditionally, we've seen that with things like software development or building product outside the US for some of my tech clients. But I've seen a lot of companies now that are rethinking their global headcount and footprint. You know, where are the skills that they could bring in? Could they create hubs of talent in a particular region or market? You know, do they need to be in the US or could they be remote? And if they're going to be remote in the US, then they could certainly be remote outside the US. It entails a lot of the same calculations we've talked about getting it right structurally, getting it right from a regulatory perspective, because those are some of the issues that I see. The other issues are, of course, how do you have an organizational culture that can extend to people that are fully remote or in different regions and markets, different languages, different work styles? How do you get a fully distributed team or a globally distributed team all marching in the same direction and to achieve the same level of success you could with your previously, you know, domestic-based team? So I've seen some new approaches developing around that, which is really interesting. And I think that's the direction we're going in. Many companies that might even be domestically focused in terms of their sales might have international teams to build that company. But then they could also leverage those international teams to develop the product, localize the product, and make it work in international jurisdictions as well, and then turn on the distribution channels outside the US as well, which could be interesting. I mean, that might be almost like a globally distributed team from the very beginning that can then build products for a domestic market first or for a global market from the very beginning. And while able to do that at lower cost of talent and leverage that cross time zone workflow, which actually, you know, we do that at my firm. I'm sitting in time zone of my clients, but my colleagues in Asia might pick something up overnight, get it to me before I hit my desk in the morning. And, you know, we've delivered something very quickly to our clients. So those kind of cross time zone workflows can actually be leveraged as well.
Yeah. So you've got money, you've got access to talent, you've got speed of delivery. So you've got a lot of benefits by doing global business.
Yeah, absolutely. Like we said, a lot of challenges too to get it right. Mm-hmm. And I've seen a lot of people get it right though. And a lot of these are kind of new issues of we're all trying to figure out how we run our businesses and grow our businesses with distributed teams or leveraging remote talent or working with people that might need to be away from the office or wherever HQ is, that could be those same skills could be achieved outside the US and be at a lower cost. So there's both kind of a market opportunity, but also a business structure and how you're able to run your business as well.
Yeah, that's certainly true. I think I could ask you questions for another hour because I'm getting so many insights, but we're encroaching an hour now. So I want to get to some personal questions for you before we end
sure,
up.
Sure, that's a fun part.
Okay. How old is your baby girl now?
17 days old.
17 days old. First baby.
Yeah. So I'm a new father. Luckily, my newborn, her name's Romy Resendez, is asleep with her mom right now, but we're new parents, and it's all been amazing and overwhelming all at the same time.
What's the first country you're gonna take her?
We were actually looking at how soon we can get her a passport. So assuming travel bans are lifted, we'll have to reassess where we can go around the world. But actually our first trip we had planned to go to into Switzerland and then go through Swiss and Italian Alps.
Oh, wonderful.
Lake region.
Yeah. We moved to Mexico when I was going into first grade and my youngest brother was 9 months old. So you'd get a passport pretty young. I think Romy's going to have one younger than we did.
Good to know. We'll just have to get her to sit still for the photo.
Yeah, well, you could do that. I'm sure you'll be able to do that. Or just layer down at this point. Most rewarding cross-cultural experience in work.
Most rewarding. I've had a lot of good ones. I mean, my day is working with people from around the world every day. You know, all of our lawyers that I work with to deliver advice to clients are somewhere else around the world. So that's been interesting. I think the most impactful was when I was really young, that university experience to, you know, first be exposed to people from all over the world and studying in a different country. I mean, that was certainly it. But I would say I did a project with the UK government. It was Tech City. So it was to build kind of the tech ecosystem of London. And this is leading up to the 2020 Olympic Games. And so it was a government and private initiative kind of combining together to really attract the next big tech companies into London. And so I worked with teams across the US, UK government teams from across their regions in APAC, Latin America, and around the world. And we'd all get together, both in London and across the US or other markets, to really set strategy and determine how we were gonna really kind of go to market and sell London as a place to go and do business and attract the right kind of companies. So that was really interesting to work with my colleagues from all around the world. And then I'd go back to Silicon Valley and then go talk to, at the time, you know, Uber or companies like that that were still domestic and start to talk to them about what they could be doing in the UK or going after opportunities in Europe.
Yeah. Wow. You've had some incredible exposure to senior people all over the world. That's great.
Yeah. Really cool opportunities.
Yeah. Any final recommendations or resources for our listeners?
Sure. There's a ton out there. In fact, I came across a doing business guide the other day that was tremendous, put together by one of the VC firms out there that helped their companies come into the US market. There's doing business guides all over the internet. I mentioned the government resources, the US Commercial Service have country guides for each individual country that any US company would ever look to go to. And then law firms like me, we have country guides. The big accounting shops have tons of free resources. I've seen some interesting tech platforms that help you determine which markets to go to around the world. There's a few that have been being developed over the years. So that kind of free research is available. And then there's some paid research ways. And then I think a lot of it is just doing due diligence, leveraging your existing network. And you'd be amazed by the experiences and the resources that many of the people you might already know have when it comes to doing business overseas or being able to tap into their network. So I think a lot of that is really just doing your research online as a starting point, seeing what ideas and information you could have. Don't rely on that, but use that as a starting point. And then with that, kind of have a better idea of what the plan is and then what you need in order to execute on that, whether that's people, expertise, or building the right team or finding the right partners and people around the world. So.
All right. So I'm sure people are going to want to expand their network and invite you into it. Where can they reach you?
Yeah, if you Google my name, Tim Rezendes, Rezendes, you can find me at osborneclark.com. I'm on the website with my email address, and I'm all over LinkedIn, of course, too. So we look forward to connect with anybody that's interested in getting together.
Okay, and Osborne Clark, why don't you spell that for us?
Yeah, it's Osborne with an E, Clark with an E, OsborneClarke.com.
I did notice that when I was writing it earlier, both with an E.
That one's tripped quite a lot of people up.
Yeah. Well, thank you everybody for listening today. I hope you learned something or got a little chuckle or smiled thinking about his new baby. If you can tell somebody that's interested in global business about the podcast, you can find it on all your favorite places to listen. We'll see you next time.
That's a wrap for this session. A big thanks to you for listening to the Global Marketing Show. Hope you had just as much fun as I did. New sessions launch weekly on all places you find podcasts, Apple, Spotify, Google Play, YouTube, and of course on our website. If you know someone interested in this topic, please tell them about us. Au revoir for now.